Ryan Stanton here with ASAP Frontline, and interestingly, in a cab right now from D.C.'s Reagan National Airport on our way into Washington, D.C. to advocate for health care and help educate and help people make hopefully wise decisions for medicine and for the patients that we take care of. And in the cab with me right now is one of my favorite doctors that probably would have never met if it weren't for politics, but one that, thank goodness, we did, because we've gotten to be friends and have a lot of common goals, and heading to the same place today, which is the Roosevelt Room at the White House, to sit down with HHS and Secretary Price and do some healthcare education and talk about how things are impacting in our local regions and with us. And Dr. Alvarado is with me, and I'll refer to him as Dr. Alvarado because that's what you are to me, and not just a congressman for the state of or Commonwealth of Kentucky. And but most importantly, his most important role is as a family practitioner, and we have a lot of patients that cross paths, and so we have a lot of the same issues and concerns when it comes to healthcare, especially dealing with a rural setting, overall rural type setting like Kentucky, but a story that plays out throughout the country. And so, Dr. Alvarado, let's talk about some of the goals that we have when it comes to this changing landscape of medicine.
Well, obviously the main objective is to try to help protect access. We want to make sure that patients have an availability to get health care, but also I think there's a growing dynamic of frustration from providers, from the number of regulations that are being imposed and the difficulty in trying to keep people practicing medicine. So we're having a difficult part even just trying to maintain access for a lot of patients. So we're worried about that. We'll have some recommendations. I think they're hoping to hear from a lot of physicians is the problems they're seeing with the current structure of medicine with the ACA, things that are difficult for patients as far as getting care, the hard part for doctors and how to provide that care. Obviously, we've got another big problem is a growing opiate problem that we have nationally, and hopefully having some insights on that. And then the other thing I want to talk about a bit too is graduate medical education funding, something that when the ACA was rolled out, Medicare was defunded to provide funds for that, and we don't have enough funding really to handle residency positions. We have more medical students than there are residency spots, and that's something else that needs to be addressed going forward, is to make sure we have enough funding to provide residency positions to train people to help take care of us in the future.
And that's the big issue, is the fact that, you know, we talk about that everybody touts, and, you know, talk about the bill that went through the House and how it may leave more uninsured, but my bigger concern and what we're noticing in our region and especially my department is that we have a growing class of underinsured, and so we have lower income and middle class Americans that are that have quote unquote insurance, but it is really more insurance in name only, and honestly, in some cases, could be considered worse than uninsured because it actually costs them money to get terrible coverage, and that's, you know, my wife and I were in that situation when we had private insurance based on a Democratic group, so we didn't have a large group negotiation capability, and we were $1,200 to $1,400 a month for our family with huge deductibles, and in the end, the insurance company was only covering about 30% of our medical bills, and for us, that's not as much of an impact, but when you're talking about, you know, folks on fixed incomes with full-time blue-collar jobs, that can be huge. And so that coupled with the fact that that there's less of you out there. I mean, there's fewer primary care physicians. Primary care physicians are leaving in droves, going into hospitalist medicine, urgent treatment medicine, into the cosmetic-type fields of medicine just because of the regulatory aspects. And we were actually talking about that before we got on the plane this morning, with how difficult it is to be a primary care physician in modern U.S. healthcare. Enlighten some of the ER physicians and providers out there, which is a lot of who listens, into the challenges you guys are facing, and why when we put follow-up with a primary care doctor on our discharge instructions, that is definitely easier said than done.
Well, a lot of it's because the reimbursements haven't really gone up as they were expected. So it's like any other business. I mean, we have increased costs just like any business would. And so for primary care, for independent practices, we can't stay afloat anymore. We're often in the red. A lot of us are selling out to corporate entities, big hospitals who run our practices, and they run them like a corporate business, so that it's no longer about that doctor and patient relationship and getting to know people. And the fun parts of medicine that a lot of physicians got into is to provide, you know, kind of get to know people, take care of their problems, you get to know their families. There's a certain joy in that job. That's been taken away, and it's just become about reimbursement. It's about something called a work RVU, which is kind of the workload that are assigned for doctors, the number of people you see, how much money's coming in, the liability aspects of it. And that, frankly, takes a lot of the fun out of the practice. And a lot of physicians, that with all those things come more regulations, more corporate requirements. You know, that doctors are spending more time looking at their computer screens and putting in data than they are actually examining their patients. And so for me, I went from seeing a pretty good volume of people per day, maybe 25 in a day, down to seeing maybe 16. My hours have gotten longer with that as well. And it's just, if you want to see somebody, it used to be a one-stop shop. They'd come in for an annual physical, and they had a couple medical problems and labs, and you would do all those things in one visit. Now the government is requiring that if you're going to do an annual physical, it has to be just the physical. It can't be any labs. You can't address any other problems that might be troubling the patient that day, and they have to come back at a separate visit and take another day off of work and have to pay another copay, and it becomes more expensive for patients, all in the name of tracking data for the sake of insurance companies and government. And it just becomes, they've turned it into a very inefficient practice of medicine, and they've interjected computers and other things into that work for doctors and for patients, where it used to be just that between those two people. Now there's so many other factors that get enrolled in that. And frankly, it's just taking the fun out of the job, and a lot of docs find it very frustrating. They can't provide the care that they know that they need to provide to their patients.
And when we think about primary care, we think about a physician and the patient. But for every patient that comes in to be seen, give us an idea of the overhead staff that's necessary to make it work. Because I think that's the biggest thing that most people, I mean, public doesn't understand. I assume some of those, the rule makers, must not understand what's involved. So give us an idea of what's involved. If you bring a patient in, who else is working on that, and what's it take?
Yeah, so if you come to the front, at least in our office, you come to the front desk, and we've got in our office two physicians and two nurse practitioners, and we're one of the bigger providers in our community, but we have probably five people that work the front desk to handle phone calls, direct calls, and handle insurance cards, the front window, take payments from people, that sort of thing. We have, as far as nursing staff, that check you in, check your vital signs, your weights, administer immunizations, gather a little bit of history for us from patients. There's three of young ladies who do that work for us, and there's one who's more of a supervisor who oversees them and then provides a lot of other administrative roles. We have really four of them that work in that capacity. We have an office manager who oversees everything in the office as well. We've got one person who just handles all the paperwork requests to fill out. So she's almost just the person who fills out a lot of the forms, pre-authorizations. We've got two people that handle just referrals to other offices, doctors, and handling a lot of those kinds of needs. Again, we've got the four providers who actually provide care there. And then we also have billers behind the scenes that people don't see. When we were in independent practice, we just had two full-time people doing nothing but the billing. Now there's an army through Kentucky One that does a lot of that. But you probably have, really, for four practitioners. When it was just private practice, we might have two support staff for each one of those providers. Now there's probably 20 people total in that office just to support those four providers to handle all the regulations, phone calls, paperwork, billing requirements. You're hiring more and more people to support them, and it just drives the cost of medicine even higher.
And that's what amazes me, is emergency medicine and primary care medicine, family medicine are very similar in that, you know, the care is actually a very small amount. In fact, you know, when you talk to physicians, physicians love healthcare. We love that time with patients and providing care, but that's become such a minority of the shift now. I mean, even in emergency medicine, the prediction is that a majority, easily a majority, 60%+ of the time is on a computer documenting. And so your average interaction time with a patient from beginning to end of their experience, all told, is about 5 minutes. And that's, you know, then that makes work very difficult. It makes relationships very difficult. It makes, you know, that what we learn in medical school, those open-ended questions, very, very difficult. And as we cruise now past the Washington Monument, about to pull up at the White House, we'll get back here in a few minutes. You know, once we're done with our meetings, we'll throughout the day update, and we'll put all this together, and it'll be Ryan and Ralph go to Washington today. That's our day. So we'll be back with more Frontline coming up. All right, so we're back, and though only several seconds have transpired for you, approximately 10 hours have transpired for us. So it's now the evening. We're returning back to the airport, about to head back, and after meetings today at the White House in the cabinet room, and that was pretty exciting and pretty cool. Now, let's put in context, things have changed, so, you know, by the time this is released, it's going to be a little bit different, but this is the day that there was the shooting at the baseball field, and, you know, so a representative was shot, and several others were as well. So it's been a little bit weird here in the Capitol with increased security, and as Dr. Alvarado mentioned, haven't seen so many automatic weapons for security in quite some time. And okay. So, yeah, it's been a little bit longer. So give us a little summary of what the experience in the room, and kind of what it was about, and where you kind of feel like we're going.
Very cool. I mean, just to be in the West Wing, I'd never been in the White House before, so to be able to be in the actual cabinet room, got to see the president make his, apparently, the daily commute from his living quarters into the Oval Office. We didn't get to look at the Oval Office, unfortunately, but we had a chance to sit down with a lot of physicians from around the country, and Dr. Price, Seema Verma, and really just an open session to discuss things that providers were encountering. And what I think I found is that the things that we've seen in Kentucky are basically happening all over the country, the same kind of burnout for physicians, over-regulation, and I think they were very receptive, and these were more listening sessions just to get some feedback and some ideas about what we would, the things that we see that are wrong. Some provided some ideas on policy changes, but a lot of it was just mostly giving them feedback, and I think they're very open to taking that feedback and making changes that are going to be meaningful to make the healthcare system something that's more sustainable, and hopefully an easier environment in which to practice medicine for physicians as well. And we kind of informed them that we're heading into a crisis if we don't make some changes very, very quickly.
And interestingly, I think with the meetings we had afterwards with mainly Kentucky contingencies, you know, with the Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell, Rand Paul, you know, it's I think it. To summarize the words that came out, I believe in January, is when it was that it came out as, quote, healthcare is hard, end quote. And that's, I think that's the feeling I'm getting is when a lot of these senators and, you know, representatives have their bill, but the senators, when now that they're tackling it, is such a huge challenge, not only with what's currently in place and what can you pull, what are you going to replace, how are we going to do it, but understanding, you know, that there has to be difficult decisions, and now the ball is in the court of the Republican side, because it's, you know, they've got control right now, and so the ball is in their court. But I think that it was also clear while we were there that it's going to take both sides to really get a viable solution in place.
Yeah, that's true, and you know, we had an opportunity later in the day to go sit down with some of the state legislators from around the country who also came and provided some input. And, you know, we had a chance to individually meet with our U.S. senators, with Senator McConnell and with Senator Rand Paul, and kind of discuss the options and the ideas. And there still is a lot of different concepts. And there's going to be some aspects that might be able to get done through the Senate, but there's going to be other things that will require bipartisan support to push through. So it is a tough task. Everybody acknowledges that. We know that the system that we have right now isn't going to work, but by the same token, everybody acknowledges we've got to do something different that's going to hopefully produce some lasting change and something that's going to, you know, at least provide coverage for, you know, for people if they want it, and be able to, something that's going to make it sustainable with doctors and with hospitals, and be able to provide services. So it's, so far it's, it's still a long ways away, I think, from being completed, but they're somewhat hopeful. At least that was the tone that I received, was that there was some hope about things getting done.
Well, I'm happy for the fact that they're actually getting the professionals, the physicians up there to tell stories, and so they can get input. I feel like that has been missing in many cases, way too much in politics, is that the people that know it, the physicians and the nurses and the PAs and nurse practitioners, are not the ones that are helping guide the decisions. And you know, it'd be like you or I trying to make decisions for I don't know, the best way to make donuts at the Dunkin' Donuts. I, you know, as much as I could read the directions, I still couldn't do it as well as they do it. And, you know, so I think having the physician input there, and, you know, I think from my standpoint, from the emergency medicine standpoint, I think our message was very similar as what you brought from primary care, was that we want to maintain access, improve access by increasing the pipeline for primary care physicians, making it more efficient, taking some of the regulations and restrictions off of physicians so we can spend more time with our patients and not putting together a 25, 30-page novel on every interaction that we have that's useless when it comes to the interaction between the physician and the patient. And then making sure, you know, that we still promote that the prudent lay person and that the patient has the right to choose, and what now the hardest thing is going to be determining how we do the coverage and how insurance works, and making sure that people have access to those types of things.
Sure, and then, you know, key thing is options. I mean, right now a lot of parts of the country don't have any options. You know, we still have millions of people that don't have any kind of coverage under the current system. And we just know that it just isn't working. I mean, people are overutilizing our emergency departments. That was very clear with a lot of the discussions. It was just the amount of regulations that, you know, take away from that patient-physician interaction, which we all crave. I think patients like, doctors like, and they want to be able to have that back. And just that the joy of medicine has been stripped away from a lot of providers. And I think the folks that are here now understand that they have an ability to be able to change that and start allowing states to have a little bit more innovation and be almost the laboratory to try out different things. I know in the second session that I went to for the state legislators, that was a big topic of discussion, was asking for flexibility, that if we do any kind of block grants for Medicaid, how that might work, how that states can use that to kind of tailor make their Medicaid program and provide true reform. So a lot of good ideas that were brought out, a lot of people shared cards, and I think they're going to continue those discussions with us. And again, that just hasn't been something we've had in the last 8 years, where there's been any interaction from the federal government with state legislatures. They're wanting to re-establish those relationships and start having input and making it more of a partnership rather than a federal government that mandates things in the states.
And from the emergency side of things, you know, you mentioned the volumes and the use of the emergency room, and states had expanded, the volumes have gone, well, the volumes have gone up everywhere, but they've gone up higher and states had expanded. And as I mentioned in the meeting, that the emergency room, the emergency medicine, the emergency department is the barometer of the healthcare system. It's the barometer of what's going on within the system. And clearly, what it's demonstrating is the access challenges of our patients, that even with insurance, that they don't have places necessarily to use it. You know, the primary care networks, the specialists that are available. And honestly, what I'm seeing more and more now is the costs associated with these plans are so high that it's basically equivalent to being uninsured with a penalty of the cost associated with it. And thus, you know, people are having to turn to the emergency department. And that's what we told them in the meeting, was that we need to empower the emergency room, because I don't believe you're going to force other than forcing people, I don't think you're going to cut the emergency department volume too much, even though I think there is some things we can do with social work, such as community paramedicine, things like that, that can help organize. But again, that's still a symbol of the system, where the system is failing these patients, and so they're having to turn to the emergency room for emergencies, but also for other stages of decompensated care. And so I think it's a good start that we had up here. But I think there's a long way to go. And I think one of the feelings I got is that we're likely to see more of a piecemeal, smaller, baby steps kind of action rather than a carte blanche revamp of the healthcare system.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think there's a sense of that if they can't get consensus, that they're going to try to gradually make changes to the system. And if they can't, they may just have to get bipartisan support to try to get some things forward. There's clearly some division from different people about how they think this thing should be approached and how it should be changed. But it can be very complicated. And you're right. I think it's nice to know that we're having discussions. I think that when the ACA was first rolled out, there was no discussions. It was a backroom deal, and it was brought out, and people voted on it without knowing what was in it. Now at least we're having some debates about what should be in it. People can be critical if they want, but that's how it's supposed to happen. So we're, like I said, I'm hopeful. I'm hopeful that we're going to get something that will hopefully in the future will work and can be sustainable.
And if you're in other areas of medicine, I believe you know you're you need to be active as well. But for emergency medicine, we definitely need to be active. I was the only emergency physician in that room today, and I think it's clear that many people don't see that viewpoint, don't see that angle, and so it's important to educate on the important role of making sure that our folks have access to the emergency departments, and that then we're given the tools to get those patients dispositioned efficiently, cost effectively, which I think there's some other things out there, including a couple of little bills and amendments from my own representative from Kentucky, Andy Barr. He's a friend of mine and also a friend of emergency medicine. And I think that will help us and allow us to be more efficient, as well as, you know, some of the changes that in Kentucky that we've seen from the guy that's sitting here right beside me, who's pushed a lot of things through in our state. And I like to see those things in the states as physicians are active. I know it's frustrating and I know it's difficult. Because it's very different than what we're used to. We're used to science and evidence, and this is a very different environment, whether it's in your state capital up here in Washington, D.C. It's a very different environment that works in a very different way. And so it can be very frustrating, and I can still remember the first couple of times I was in Frankfurt talking, and I left there wanting to find the closest cinder block wall to run my head through just because it was so frustrating. You know, you've made that jump, and I want to talk about that for a minute. You made that decision, and we talked about it on our walk from the White House to the Capitol, which seems like it shouldn't be that far, but we were able to get many very long stories and lose much weight from sweat today. As a physician in politics, state politics, tell me what made you get into it, and what others can do, what other physicians can do, and why we need physicians to be involved.
Yeah, so the original, you know, the original thing that motivated me was tort reform, the lack of tort reform in Kentucky, and had a state senator at the time who I remember approaching and letting him know the importance of it. He was a swing vote, and in the end, he just didn't vote yes or no, he just didn't vote. He abstained, I think, just because he was nervous to vote, and that angered me. I think I told my wife I need to get more involved, and someone came knocking on our door, canvassing for Ernie Fletcher when he was running for governor, and she said, hey, my husband wants to get more involved. So I blame my wife, ultimately, but that wound up, they contacted me and said, hey, would you be interested in running? And I said yes, and so I started down that political road at that time and started running for office, and really a lot of it was for that motivation, was being tired of watching legislators who clearly didn't understand medicine making decisions about medicine. And as doctors, we're used to giving an order and it gets carried out and you get results. In the world of politics, it's much different. Even though you feel like you have a better understanding, there is still a consensus, and you have to convince colleagues to move forward and move on positions. And to come in and just tell people this is what needs to happen, then you're viewed as rude, and it's a very negative reaction. So you have to get to know people, and you've got to develop relationships within the Senate. And then it's also the same thing with your own state representative and state senator. So I tell most doctors they're going to get involved. The first thing you got to do is vote. I think we'll probably be surprised at how many colleagues don't vote at all on issues. Secondly, they need to get to know their state legislators and their federal legislators and know who they are. And, you know, I think as doctors, we often view politics as dirty, something that's sometimes beneath us. We have a bit more of an altruistic mentality in how we approach life. And unfortunately, just sometimes meeting with people and talking to them, that goes pretty long. But sometimes you have to put your money where your mouth is, too. And so people often have to get involved financially in campaigns. And that's what catches the attention, unfortunately, of a lot of our legislators. But the people who can do that successfully then develop a relationship and a trust. And then when those legislators are very nervous to vote on a bill, they'll come to you as a doc to say, what do you think about this? I know you, I trust you, you've helped me, so therefore, what do you think I should do on this? And then they come and seek your advice. And really, the reality is that legislators are scared to death of making changes in healthcare because they don't understand it, and they know that the impact can be huge and can tick off a lot of people in their district. They want to have the cover of going to medical professionals in their community to say, I spoke to these people, they told me it was the right thing to do, and I voted based on their recommendations. And that's how you can start having a lot of influence. So it's just really very important. Vote, get out there, get involved. And the other ultimate idea is just to run for office. And we need more doctors in politics, ultimately. The ratio of physicians in office today are much less than they were around the time of the Revolution, when many of the signers of the Declaration of Independence were actually physicians. And so it's important for us to get back being involved, to make our voices heard on that. And if you want to take a financial hit but willing to provide some true public service, I tell a lot of physicians to look at trying to get that done, even if it's for a period of time, to help push agenda items and issues. And typically, again, your voice, people will defer to your voice on a lot of those issues if you did get elected into office.
So how can folks get in touch with you, either email, social media, whatnot?
Yeah, so I'm on Facebook. I do Twitter, but my Facebook links over to my Twitter, but you can follow me in either one of those. If you have ideas, I tell people to email me at ralph.alvarado@lrc.ky.gov. So that's ralph.alvarado is A-L-V like Victor, A-R-A, D as in Delta O, at lrc.ky.gov. So if you send me emails there, Facebook me, you can people can message me on there. They can often find me on Twitter, and they'll often... If it's a quick question I can answer, sometimes some people will have very, you know, they want a quick response to a very big question. I tell them to go ahead and email me because I can give them a little bit more detail. But any of those, feel free to fire away. I'm pretty quick to respond.
So you're telling me you can't answer the healthcare debate in 140 characters or less?
There are some who have asked me my position on a certain topic, and I say, hey, listen, I can't do it in 140 characters. Email me, and I'll give you my response. And that doesn't satisfy them. They want the quick yes or no, and it's there isn't an exact even yes or no on some questions. And so I try to provide them a little bit more insight through email.
All right. And so we're approaching Reagan National Airport here and our way back to the Bluegrass. So we'll give that as a good time to call it quits for the day. As for me, you can contact me, youreverydaymedicine@gmail.com, youreverydaymedicine@gmail.com. Also, follow along on Twitter, @everydaymed. And then make sure you like our Facebook page, ASAP Frontline. That way you can keep up with the weekly releases of the podcast. And until next time, I'm Dr. Ryan Stanton, and this has been some ASAP Frontline.